With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Danielle Leal.
Hey everyone, Danielle Leal here, host of AgNet West AgNet News Hour. Thanks for joining me this morning. Rolling right into our headline teases of the day. Brian German is chatting with us about the Save Our Communities event that highlighted the need to address SGMA impacts in the San Joaquin Valley. We're also bringing you the details on pistachio shipments that are up over last year despite the overall supply chain issues. Sabrina Halverson has today's National Spotlight on combating livestock diseases. And I'm going to go ahead and start off today's program with the role of biotechnology and pesticides in sustainable farming practices. Chris Novak, who's the president and CEO of Crop Life America, says biotechnology and pesticides play a role in sustainable farming.
As we look at how we're using pesticides, they have helped farmers reduce the amount of tillage, whether they have to plow the soil or disc the soil. More farmers today are using no-till or minimum tillage systems, which means there's less soil running off, but also that means there's more nutrients, and the pesticides that we apply are staying in the fields where they can do the most good for the plants.
Novak shares an example of how farmers are doing more with less thanks to biotechnology.
We also, though, are finding ways to utilize pesticides and biotechnology to help plants be more productive. On the farm where I grew up in eastern Iowa, when my dad was farming, a good year for corn production was about 160 bushels to the acre. A couple years ago, I was riding with the gentleman who farms our ground today, and he was getting 230 to 250 bushels to the acre. That's a significant increase, which means that we're feeding more families from that 100-acre farm that sits in eastern Iowa than we were 20 years ago. And it's because of new technologies and tools like pesticides and biotechnology.
Stay tuned as we continue this conversation throughout our shows today. Right now, we have more agriculture news with AgNet West, Brian German.
City mayors, lawmakers, county supervisors, ag industry members, and other stakeholders all came together in Visalia last week to discuss how SGMA is going to impact the Central Valley and how to navigate the challenges ahead. California Fresh Fruit Association President Ian LeMay said the meeting was an important step in bringing communities together with a unified voice to help mitigate the effect that SGMA will have on the San Joaquin Valley as a whole.
Well, we find ourselves at a critical point. Not only is SGMA being implemented based on the timeline set forth by the law, but we also find ourselves in a third year of a critical drought. And why we came here together today was to have a needed discussion on how the collective of agriculture, private business, education, rural communities can work together to go to our state government and our federal government and make sure that they understand the associated impacts with this drought and SGMA implementation and try to find collective solutions that we can advocate jointly on. I think today was a good first introductory conversation. As Roger Isom said, I think there's a need for more meetings like this. The conversation will not get easier. It will get harder. But this region, to be effective, has to stay together. And I was very pleased with the dialogue today. And walking away from here, I think there's a plan that we can start to execute.
Pistachio shipments are up over last year despite the ongoing logistical challenges. President of American Pistachio Growers Richard Matoyan said there's been good news for the industry with some of the latest data on shipments.
The latest shipments that we have are through the month of March, and what they are showing is that shipments continue to be up in every export market, with the exception of Europe. And we know now that Europe is starting to pull more product from the United States. So it's a very, very positive message in light of the continuing issues that we have at the ports and everything else that we're having to deal with, that the shipments remain up. And I certainly hear a lot of stories with a lot of tree nut commodities about being able to secure containers, and we certainly have that problem as well. But when I look at the shipment numbers and see that we are up in every market with the exception of one, I think we're holding our own and actually doing pretty well. The other bit of good news that I'm hearing is that the crop appears to be off again in our biggest competitor country, which is Iran. They had some weather-related problems this year, so they're not going to have a large crop. So if the world is looking for pistachios, they're really going to have to look to the United States to be the provider of a product.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
You're listening to AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
You're going to need me.
You're going to need us.
All of us.
You're going to need our help with your water, your air, your food.
You're going to need our determination, our compassion.
You're going to need the next generation of leaders to face the challenges the future will bring.
And we promise we'll be there when you need us.
Today, 4-H is growing the next generation of leaders. Support us at 4-H.org.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal, tossing it right on over to Sabrina Halverson with today's National Spotlight.
In today's National Spotlight, avian flu continues to spread in the U.S., while African swine fever poses a continuing threat to the nation's hog producers. Avian flu continues to show up in more than half the states and now has infected at least one person who was culling a poultry flock in Colorado. USDA Secretary Tom Vilsack updated House Ag lawmakers at the end of April.
As of today, there are roughly 29 states that have dealt with and are dealing with AI. Roughly 200, almost 240 flocks have been impacted and affected. In 21 states, it's both commercial and backyard flocks. In 8 states, it's just simply backyard.
He says that highlights the need for surveillance.
We have 585 folks between the federal and state efforts here focused on this on a daily basis. We're concerned, obviously, about rapid spread, and that's why we have encouraged producers to be very cautious and very careful about biosecurity.
With improvements, Vilsack says, from the 2014-2015 outbreak in identifying, isolating, and depopulating infected flocks. As for African swine fever,
obviously the goal here is to make sure it doesn't hit the mainland. We've created a protective zone in Puerto Rico. We're working with the Dominican Republic and Haitian officials to begin the process of trying to get it under control in those countries.
Providing resources, staff, and lab facilities while bulking up U.S. security through customs and airport ads to keep out items that might compromise the U.S. pork industry. Interesting information for those who follow long-term weather cycles. A farmer from the 1800s, a university professor from Iowa, and a commodity analyst all believe that we're in the final 3 years of an 89-year weather cycle. According to the Brenner cycle, recently observed extreme weather events will continue for another 3 years, then will return to relative normal in 2025. Samuel Brenner was a farmer who lived in the mid-1800s and discovered that the width of tree rings can tell the long-term history of annual wet and dry seasons. A century and a half later, his research method is still viewed as a natural history record of seasonal weather trends. Mo Agostino is an agricultural commodity risk analyst and hosts annual crop tours. He and Dr. Elwin Taylor, a climatologist and meteorologist with Iowa State University, believe the Brenner cycle describes an 89-year drought cycle that culminates in a 6-year subset period before the long-term cycle begins again. This trend shows the current 6-year subset period started in 2019 and will continue to cause crop shortfalls until about 2025. Agostino explains.
Dr. Elwin Taylor from Iowa State University has gone back over 400 years. He has come up with this 89-year drought cycle. The last one was the 1930s, that peaked in 1936. So it's a 6-year cycle, started in 2019. This is the third year, should peak sometime in 2025. That's when Mother Nature will allow the globe to overproduce.
Now he says the current weather events do correlate with the mid-1930s Dust Bowl years that were not exclusive to North America. Since Professor Taylor's discussion last fall, Agostino has looked at heat, resulting droughts, and other severe weather events in various parts of the world.
Morocco's very dry. Pakistan, India experienced 120-degree days. Southern part of Brazil and Argentina experiencing 113-degree weather. Their normal average temperature is 85 degrees. You go back to last year, the Western Canadian prairies. Here comes a heat dome that came out of nowhere, 120 degrees, and fries half of the crops. It just goes on and on and on.
So according to Professor Taylor and Agostino, weather patterns will continue to be extreme for the next few years. But if the Brenner cycle is valid, 2025 should see a return to more normal patterns. But until then, both dry and wet will be the norm. The NAFB contributed to that report. That's today's National Spotlight. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
Thanks, Sabrina. And now for today's livestock report, here's Randall Wiseman.
Well, in today's livestock news, according to new data released by the U.S. Department of Agriculture and compiled by the U.S. Meat Export Federation, U.S. beef exports soared to another new value record in March. Pork exports that month were the largest so far this year, but well below the record large totals that were posted in March of last year. But beef exports totaled 126,285 metric tons in March. That's up 1% from a year ago, the third largest on record. Value climbed 33% to a record $1.07 billion. First quarter exports are up 6% compared to last year, with a value of just over $3 billion. According to USMEF President and CEO Dan Hallstrom, while this momentum is fueled by mainstay markets like South Korea, Japan, and Taiwan, demand is also very strong in China, Hong Kong, and key Latin American markets, while exports to the Middle East have rebounded impressively. Now, when it comes to pork exports in March, they were at 222,581 metric ton. That's the largest since November, but nearly 25% below the record volume achieved a year ago. Export value at $615.3 million, also the highest since November, but down 23% year over year. Now, first quarter pork exports fell 20% from a year ago. Value at $1.71 billion is down 17%. Hallstrom explained that while pork exports were down significantly from last year, we did see some encouraging trends. U.S. pork commanded a higher pace per pound than a year ago with outstanding demand from Mexico and value growth in key markets like South Korea and the Dominican Republic. Hallstrom added that both beef and pork exporters continue to face logistical obstacles and delays when moving product overseas. If you'd like to see a detailed summary of the first quarter export results, you can go to the USMEF website, usmef.org. Well, some wonder how the current avian influenza outbreak being seen in parts of our country compares to the big one back in 2015. Well, Gary Crawford has a story explaining how they do compare.
During the 2015 U.S. outbreak of avian influenza, over 50 million chickens and turkeys died as flocks were culled to slow the spread of the virus. So what about this current outbreak?
I don't necessarily think we're going to get to the 50 million bird situation that we had in 2015.
Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack telling farm broadcasters one reason he feels we're not going to lose 50 million birds this time is...
Because I think our producers are doing a better job from a biosecurity perspective. They understand and appreciate the necessity of closing things down and making sure that they're careful.
Vilsack, who was Ag Secretary during that 2015 outbreak, says this time it seems to be less stressful for the industry as well.
Because we've been through this, we understood the importance of early identification, of being able to quarantine, to depopulate quickly and dispose properly, which that was some of the challenges in 2015. We didn't have all that in place.
Also, this time the virus has hit more backyard flocks, fewer commercial facilities. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Thanks, Gary. And I'm Randall Wiseman for Agnet West.
You're listening to Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
Agnet West Radio Network, your trusted agriculture news provider for the state of California. Stay up to date with accurate local and national agriculture news on this station or by visiting us online at agnetwest.com. Get even more connected by following us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter by searching at Agnet West and our team of Brian German at Brian German Agnet West and Danielle Leo with at D Leo Agnet West.
You've been listening to the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
The U.S. is once again helping to feed the world. That's coming up on This Land of Ours. The United States has long prided itself in our ability to feed the world. Administration leaders have taken another step to do just that. The U.S. Department of Agriculture and the U.S. Agency for International Development are drawing down the full balance of the Bill Emerson Humanitarian Trust. It's part of an effort to provide $670 million in food assistance to countries in need as a result of Putin's invasion of Ukraine. The USDA says the world is suffering from historic levels of global food insecurity, exacerbated by Russia's war in Ukraine and its effects on global food supplies. Available estimates suggest an additional 40 million people could be pushed into poverty and food insecurity as a result of Russia's aggression. USAID will use $282 million to procure U.S. food commodities for six countries facing severe food insecurity: Ethiopia, Kenya, Somalia, Sudan, South Sudan, and Yemen. USDA will provide $388 million in additional funding through the Commodity Credit Corporation to cover shipping costs. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
Thanks, Sabrina. And now for today's agricultural law and tax report, here's Roger McGowan.
This is the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McGowan. Many in agriculture are worried about a potential change in the income tax basis at death rule. Will it be changed? If so, what might the impact be? Currently, an asset that is included in a decedent's estate at death for tax purposes receives an income tax basis in the hands of the heir equal to the asset's fair market value. This is known as stepped-up basis. If the heir were to sell the asset, capital gain tax for the heir would be computed on the difference between the selling price of the asset and the value at the time the heir inherited the asset. For an asset that is sold shortly after inheritance, the capital gain tax is likely to be minimal to none. A proposal to change the rule to allow a step-up only in certain limited situations and only to a limited extent did not become law in 2021. Will the rule change occur in 2022? I doubt it, but it's an issue worth watching. Ag assets typically have a low basis, either from being owned for many years or because of income tax planning strategies. Agriculture would feel the pain of a rule that doesn't provide for a fair market value at death basis for inherited assets. Stay as flexible as possible with your estate plan to be able to deal with a potential rule change, even though such a change looks unlikely. This has been the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McGowan.
Again, that was today's Agricultural Law and Tax Report. And in more agriculture news, are we at the end of a long-term weather cycle? Well, Dennis Guy has more in this next report.
If you're a believer in long-term weather cycles, a farmer from the 1800s, an Iowa University professor, and a Canadian commodity analyst all believe that we're in the final 3 years of an 89-year weather cycle. According to the Brenner cycle, recently observed extreme weather events will continue for another 3 years, then return to relative normal in 2025. Samuel Brenner, a farmer who lived in the mid-1800s, discovered that the width of tree rings can tell the long-term history of annual wet and dry seasons. A century and a half later, his research method is still viewed as a natural history record of seasonal weather trends. Mo Agostino, a Canadian agricultural commodity risk analyst, hosts an annual crops tour across the Farm Belt of Ontario. Last year, a guest on that tour, Dr. Elwin Taylor, a climatologist and meteorologist with Iowa State University, has studied tree rings going back 400 years. He believes the Brenner cycle describes an 89-year drought cycle that culminates in a 6-year subset period before the long-term cycle begins again. The current 6-year subset period started in 2019 and will continue to cause crop shortfalls until about 2025. Agostino explains.
The Brenner cycle is a long-term weather cycle focused on tree rings. You know, the width of a tree ring would tell you whether it was a dry year or lots of moisture. Dr. Elwin Taylor from Iowa State University has gone back over 400 years. He has come up with this 89-year drought cycle. The last one was the 1930s, that peaked in 1936. So it's a 6-year cycle, started in 2019. This is the third year, should peak sometime in 2025. That's when Mother Nature will allow the globe to overproduce.
Mo Agostino said current weather events do correlate with the mid-1930s Dust Bowl years that were not exclusive to North America. Since Professor Taylor's discussion last fall, Agostino has looked at heat resulting in droughts and other severe weather events in various parts of the world.
Morocco's very dry. Pakistan, India experienced 120-degree days. Southern part of Brazil and Argentina experiencing 113-degree weather. Their normal average temperature is 85 degrees. You go back to last year, the Western Canadian prairies. Here comes a heat dome that came out of nowhere, 120 degrees, and fries half of the crops. It just goes on and on and on.
So, according to Professor Taylor and Mo Agostino, weather patterns will continue to be extreme for the next few years. But if the Brenner cycle is valid, 2025 should see a return to more normal patterns. But until then, both dry and wet will be the norm.
Even though this pattern is a drier drier pattern. In the winters, you can get extreme snowfall or extreme cold temperatures. Like last year, with an east versus west, where the east was just constantly getting moisture day after day and created a lot of disease. So when you put the whole thing together, go to a new normal, but it may not be to 2025.
Mo Agostino is a commodity risks analyst with Farms.com, based in London, Ontario. Reporting from Canada, I'm Dennis Guy.
You're listening to Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
Why do we have GMOs? Actually, we've been modifying crops for thousands of years to prevent crop loss from pest and weather damage, to grow more food on less land, even to improve nutrition. Today, GMOs are developed for the same reasons. With genetic engineering, scientists can change and improve crops more easily and quickly. Feed your mind with more GMO facts on FDA's website.
Welcome back to the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West, providing you with statewide agriculture news daily. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Now let's listen in to more featured segments.
The ongoing White House Rural Infrastructure Tour, associated with the bipartisan infrastructure law, has among its emphasis job creation associated with various projects. As Deputy Agriculture Secretary Jules Bernard explains about the various opportunities throughout BIL and USDA to improve rural economies and quality of life.
It's going to really help relieve the bottlenecks, strengthen supply chains, and our ability to move products faster to the market, which you can imagine will be powerful for our farmers and ranchers and for our rural businesses to get to their markets. And focusing on upgrading the power infrastructure, environmental remediation, and clean and safe drinking water will also empower and revitalize our rural communities and our urban communities. And just investments in rural infrastructure, in preserving our lands, our natural resources, and outdoor recreation will be incredible.
Yet job creation will also take place within the federal government, and therefore the need for qualified applicants to fill positions.
We need all kinds of people coming into the federal government to fulfill this new law. We need engineers. We need scientists. We need folks who are good with business, with numbers. We've got a lot of resources we need to push out the door to rural communities, so we need people who can work on grants administration, contracts administration.
According to the director of the Office of Personnel Management, Karen Ahuja, OPM is the human resources arm of the federal government. As Deputy Agriculture Secretary Bernard points out, when it comes to positions available within the department,
we are seeking 3,000 positions to be filled, and we cannot do this without OPM.
OPM Director Ahuja says with BIL projects across the country and federal employment opportunities in general,
80% of federal jobs are outside of Washington, D.C.
Such job opportunities now and in the future are posted at the following web address, www.bil.usajobs.gov. Potential applicants can
put in search terms, see if there's something that interests them. Oftentimes you'll see, especially with field offices, not only for USDA, but other agencies, there are opportunities in your local communities. Some of these positions are being listed as remote. Also, as we're in our new environment of doing our jobs in lots of different ways, what you can do on usajobs.gov is you can build out your resume. You can link to lots of different opportunities. So we hope people not just look for that one job, that they find multiple opportunities that speak to them.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Good day, everybody. Albert J. Hernandez, the Untamed Chef for Agnet West. Welcome to the California Kitchen, where you can learn how to cook from an award-winning chef in under 3 minutes or less. I'm your host with the most. Let's get untamed. A special thank you to my wonderful sponsor, Emusa USA, www.emusausa.com. Here you can find anything from pressure cookers to spoons, ladles, you name it, anything kitchen, you're going to find it here at EmusaUSA.com. Great quality. They've been around for a long, long time. My pressure cooker is over 12 years old and it still works as good as the day I bought it. And I use that thing about two times a day. So I promise you, this is one of those really incredible recipes you're absolutely going to love. And this is a company you're absolutely going to love. www.EmusaUSA.com. www.thefederalandstateeffort.com. So my recipe today is vegan. Yes, I said it. Vegan pozole. Now, when you think of pozole, you think of chicken, you think of pork, you think of all kinds of other different meats that could go into your pozole. However, the base for great pozole is all vegan, vegetarian, whatever you want to call it, but the flavor is solid and it's always there. You're going to love this recipe. This is my recipe for guajillo vegetarian pozole. Let's get untamed. So the very first thing I need to do, our very first step, is take 2 ounces of guajillo chili pods. I'm going to also add to that a half an ounce of onion. It could be a yellow onion, it could be a white onion, a purple red onion, whatever you want, but it's got to be a half an ounce of onion and 2 quarts of vegetable stock. I'm going to bring the chilies. Now remember this, whenever you're working with dry chili pods, we want to make sure the chili pods are clean. This is very, very important. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to seed them out, make sure all the dry seeds come out of the pod, and I'm going to put it into my stock. Now this is very important right here, and you can't forget this at all. Always remove the stem. I have a lot of people who just throw everything in the pot. They don't remove the stem. And it's probably not going to kill you, but at the same time, it doesn't taste very good. And if I'm trying to teach you guys how to do something, I want to teach you how to do it right. So you're going to remove the stem from that as well. And what we're going to do is blend all of this after it's cooked for about a good 10 minutes. Bring it to a boil, then bring it to a simmer. If it looks like the liquids went down a little bit, you can add a little bit more stock, but don't overdo it. I'd say maybe add 2 more cups at the most. Now what I'm going to do on the side is I'm going to prepare my cabbage, my onions. We're going to dice those. Our cabbage, we're going to do a nice julienne slice on that. 4 ounces of fresh cilantro, and get a lemon and cut it into 4 pieces. That way you got some fresh lemon you can squeeze on this as well. Now this is done in a pressure cooker. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take my hominy. And for hominy, I'm going to do 3/4 of a quart. So we're going to have quite a bit of hominy in there. Remember, there's nothing else in there. So the base of this pozole is a hominy. We're going to put that in our pressure cooker, and we're going to put the lid over the top of this. We're going to cook this for 20 minutes. I promise you, once it comes to a boil and you hear that pressure coming out, turn it to a simmer of a flame and just let it do its thing. This is going to be one of the most incredible pozoles you ever wanted. If you want, you can also add some roasted asparagus to it, but not necessary. But right now, asparagus is super amazing because it's in season right now. So I highly recommend put some of that asparagus in there and enjoy. I'm Albert J. Hernandez, and you all know me as the Untamed Chef from Agnet West.
This is the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search Agnet News Hour or Agnet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's Agnet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
Over the years, you've brought them into your home. You were prescribed opioids after the C-section and after Dad's back injury. They helped when you were in pain, and you held on to them, just in case. But did you know holding on to unused opioids puts your family at risk? Trouble with opioids can start at home with unused medicines, such as pills, patches, and syrups. You can remove the risk and protect your family. Find out how at www.fda.gov/drugdisposal.
Welcome back to the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. For today's interview segment, we have another episode of Voices of the Valley. And this week's episode is the first of a 2-part series where show host Dennis Donahue and Candace Wilson discuss successful approaches to ag tech innovation with the folks from Verdant Robotics.
Welcome to Voices of the Valley, a series interviewing growers, entrepreneurs, educators, and technologists who are inventing new solutions for today's and tomorrow's challenges on the farm. Brought to you by Reedley College, educating the next generation of agriculturalists in advanced technology, efficient production practices, and food safety. Now here's your hosts of Voices of the Valley, Dennis Donahue and Candace Wilson.
This is Dennis Donahue, the director of Western Growers Center for Innovation and Technology, joined once again by my good friend and partner, Candace Wilson. And Candace, you ready to do another Voices of the Valley?
I'm so looking forward to it.
Well, I'm fine, but this one's kind of intriguing because normally we outnumber our guests 2-1. This time we got a twofer. So this one could be interesting as we welcome our good friends from Verdant Robotics, two of the co-founders, Curtis Garner and Gabe Sibley. Gentlemen, welcome.
Thanks. Hey, Dennis, great to be here.
All right. And like I said, we're a little intimidated. This is 2-on-2, so you guys go easy on us. We're delighted you're here. And, you know, one of the things we like to do before we kind of jump into the technology and what you're doing and reads on the marketplace is, could both of you, and Curtis, we'll start with you, and then Gabe, get to you. Tell us a little bit about your background and then how you got to founding Verdant Robotics. And I ask that, one, because we just like our listeners to know who we're visiting with and their background. But what I think is interesting about that question also is both of you really have terrific backgrounds, have seen a lot of things, could have gone in a number of different directions with your background, but you settled on Verdant Robotics. So, you know, so how did you get there and why Verdant? Curtis?
Yeah, thanks, Dennis. So Curtis Garner, co-founder of Verdant Robotics. My background as an operations manager for the world's largest processing tomato facility. So I ran harvesting and transplanting for roughly 40 to 50,000 acres every year. I did that for quite a few years and then ultimately was working like 4,000 hour years in ag, you know, running a very large at scale operations. Met my wife and decided I should do something a little bit different. There's more to life than just being a workaholic. And so I joined a very large farm, so Ken and Michael at Bowles Farming, so 12,000 acre diversified row crop farm. Joined them as a business analyst, so helped them go from 14 crops up to 21, organic and conventional production. But at that time, minimum wage, SB3 was, minimum wage was going to $15 per hour, then the ag exemptions to overtime were going to go away. And we're roughly going to double the labor budget on the farm. So, you know, as all your listeners know, farmers are price takers, not price makers. And so my love for computers and agriculture kind of led me to put one foot in front of the other and have a chance meeting by a company called Moog that introduced me to Gabe. They did some old DARPA projects with Gabe and they put us in a room together and we had dinner and a couple drinks and decided that we should get married and they should put the bill. And to much to our chagrin, they did.
We knew this was going to be interesting. Old DARPA projects, met in the back room, had some drinks. Gabe, what have you got to say for yourself?
Yeah, exactly. So let's see here. I guess say I'm a roboticist. So I've been in robotics and computer vision and machine learning for a little over a few decades now. So I got pulled into Silicon Valley for the whole self-driving car thing. I've been doing that for a long time. Spent some time at a company called Zoox and then another company called Zippy, which is sold to General Motors. And then, yeah, the folks at Moog who I worked with on DARPA programs, you know, they built all the actuation for all the Boston Dynamics robots. And we've been active in those projects. And they were looking for places where robotics technology could be impactful. And they really felt like ag was a great spot. And so they were looking for people in ag who were switched on. They found Curtis. And they introduced us. And yeah, we were in a bar down in San Jose and Curtis and I looked at each other in the eyes and realized, wow, you know, there's something here. And it was fantastic. You know, we spent 6 months going around speaking to folks like yourself and getting introductions to farmers, trying to understand if there was a way that a lot of the technology that, you know, has been deployed successfully in space and military applications and that we're struggling, frankly, to deploy into the self-driving car world might be able to help out in agriculture. And lo and behold, there's incredible need. There's incredibly strong fit. There's places where the technology can be really helpful. And there's a bunch of really great folks to work with on a totally meaningful and impactful, you know, line of work. So, you know, thanks to the guys at Moog really for having the eye to put us together. And then since then, a lot of folks have just come out of the woodworks because they're inspired by the opportunity and the impact to do something valuable and meaningful.
Can we just pause for a quick second on agriculture and talk about Boston Dynamics? The robots are dancing.
Yeah, they're awesome.
They are amazing. I love watching the progress of the Boston Dynamics robots.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean,
the question that I have is, first, do they watch the humans do the dance? Or how are they taught to dance to the specific music?
Yeah. I'm being serious.
Honestly, I couldn't tell you how they do what they do right now. Mm-hmm. You know, some of the older stuff 15 years ago that I was involved with, I'd have a better shot at. I've always been a perception guy. So, you know, see the world and understand it before you, you know, try to make intelligent actions in the world. Yeah. And the Boston Dynamics guys have historically been control and path planning guys, and they're the best in the world. They're phenomenally good. And that's why they can build those gymnastic platforms. And also, quite frankly, some of the secret sauce is in the muscles behind those machines that folks like Moog really delivered and made possible, the really amazing actuators.
Interesting. Dennis, the robots are also doing backflips now.
Oh yeah. No, I've seen the video. Seen the video, you know, and you know, but if we could hit a few real markets, we can see people doing backflips too out in the field. So the ability to do backflips should be important with whatever features you build in.
Gabe, maybe you could give them the story about the product market fit in the all singing, dancing robot, story.
Yeah, maybe I'll see if I can get this right. You know, why we were not a solution looking for a problem, if that's what you're talking about. You know, we spent a long time trying to figure out what was the right thing to do. You know, 6 months on the road talking to farmers, as opposed to showing up with a bunch of technology and saying, hey, you know, here we're a solution looking for a problem. In many ways, you know, a lot of business plans in robotics, especially out of Silicon Valley, you got roboticists that are excited about robots and they want to, you know, figure out something to do with the robots that could make money, as opposed to sort of looking at the technology more broadly and actually sitting with a farmer, with a partner in whatever business it's in and just doing something the customer wants. I think, Curtis, you're probably talking about something else, but it is pretty important and it has been for us. You know, it's kind of like MBA business school one-on-one, you know, do what the customer wants, but that was super important for us and it wouldn't have been possible without Curtis because, you know, he's the better half of the equation, the farmer DNA, and we took us around on it listening to her.
You're listening to AgNet NewsHour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
Irrigation in arid California is as complicated as it is essential. Unpredictable supplies, uneven distribution, complicated application schedules, and regulation make it a challenge. No wonder help with water is the biggest request at USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service. Since 2014, NRCS has invested over $100 million helping over 1,000 California farmers conserve water. By using superior technology and savvy management, farmers get more crops with fewer drops. Join the Water Savings Club. Contact your local NRCS office. NRCS, helping people help the land since 1935.
You've been listening to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
Two student ambassadors have been selected to represent the California Milk Advisory Board in Mexico during the 2022 International Internship Program. The goal of the program is to provide young agriculture and dairy college students an opportunity to learn about dairy foods and marketing in the international marketplace for the purpose of developing leaders who will serve on dairy industry boards, work in dairy foods processing, or in sales or marketing. Lauren Dutra of Hanford and Sienna Roland of Riverdale were recently announced as this year's student participants based on their academic achievement, their connection to the California dairy industry, and a willingness to travel abroad and learn more about international dairy sales. Over a six-week period, the interns will spend time with in-country CMAB marketing organization Imalinks to gain a better understanding of these markets, consumer buying habits, and promotional efforts on behalf of California's dairy industry. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
Thanks, Brian. And in more agriculture news, farmers markets are among local consumer options. I've got more in my next report. Undersecretary for Marketing and Regulatory Programs Jenny Lester Moffitt opened up the 2022 USDA Farmers Market in Washington, D.C. She discusses the importance of farmers markets nationwide.
The 25th season of the USDA Farmers Market. We are back and we are ready to go after a two-year hiatus. This market started in 1995 as a living demonstration of USDA's commitment to local and regional food systems. DC has many farmers markets that are supporting local and regional food economies and providing important access to nutritious food right here at farmers markets. In fact, there are over 8,000 farmers markets across the country that are doing this. These markets are allowing producers to be in their communities, to provide options for consumers, and to experience the local and regional food varieties that we all really, really enjoy.
And after being shut down for 2 years due to the pandemic, the farmers market has finally opened. And it's right next to the newly opened People's Garden, located right outside of USDA. And rounding out today's show with a May and June wildfire outlook. National Interagency Fire Center meteorologist Jim Wallman discusses the outlook for wildfire season around the nation, particularly here in the West during the month of May.
We're looking at above normal fire potential in most of the Southwest, from Southeast Arizona through most of New Mexico into the adjacent high plains of Texas and Oklahoma, and then also up into the Front Range of Colorado toward the Four Corners region. And then some other areas that we're also a little bit concerned about for this month will be across the higher elevations of the Southern Great Basin in Nevada and Utah, and then some of the lower elevations in Northern California, such as the Bay Area, the Sacramento Valley, where some of the lower elevation grasses are quite robust. There's a lot of growth from last December over the winter that are starting to dry out.
And his thoughts for the month of June.
The fire potential we're expecting above normal from the high plains of Texas, Oklahoma, and western Kansas, west through all the Southwest, through the Four Corners, most of Colorado, and continuing in the higher elevations of the Southern Great Basin of Nevada and Utah, and then spreading across all of Northern California, north of Sacramento and the Bay Area, and continuing up into Central Oregon. And then another area that looks to be maybe starting a little bit more significant activity a little bit earlier than the peak season will be portions of the Northern High Plains, Montana, Western Dakotas, Northeast Wyoming, and the Black Hills.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit Agnet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at Agnet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Danielle Leal, Brian German, and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the Agnet News Hour from Agnet West. Agnet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.